Hello, and welcome to Ed Infinitum, the podcast that makes school the subject of study. I'm your host, David Nuremberg. This is Season 1, Episode 5, Group Work That Doesn't Stink. When you were in school and your teacher announced, "Okay, class, we're going to be doing group projects," did you experience a feeling of dread? I sure did. I hated group work when I was in middle school, high school, even college. Yet I've been employing it for almost 2 decades in my own teaching practice, and I talk it up with all the schools I consult for. So in this episode, I'm going to address the question not only of why I do that, but more importantly, how I do it, and what my experience and the research tells us about how to engage students in effective cooperative learning, or, in the words of a former student of mine, group work that doesn't stink. Effective cooperative learning is one of those 21st century skills and competencies that you hear bandied around in discussions of the future of education. How we need to prepare students for cooperative work in their future careers, because, let's face it, any job out there, possible exception of professional hermit, is going to require a person to work on a team at least some of the time. A 2016 study by the group 5 Dynamics surveyed workers between the ages of 25 and 64 in a variety of fields across the nation, and found the majority of them did work in teams, yet many felt they lacked adequate preparation and skill sets for effective cooperative work. So schools have a real mission here to help students learn how to do that. But the benefits of cooperative learning go beyond just career competencies in the future. They help students learn in the here and now. Here's some of what the research says. A meta-analysis of 168 studies conducted in 2014 demonstrated that individual students showed benefits after working collaboratively, specifically when it came to the acquisition of new material, the retention of learned material, and higher-order problem-solving skills when compared with students who are working individually only. Many other studies attest to how group dialogue can help students make sense of new learning. There's one field of educational theory that would most definitely not be surprised by these findings, and that's social constructivism. I promise I'll do a full episode on this school of thought and its founder, Lev Vygotsky, because wow, is his story interesting. I'll just say it co-stars John Dewey, Joseph Stalin, and the Republic of Uzbekistan. But the relevant part here today is Vygotsky's theory, developed in the 1930s and since refined, that posits that all human learning is, to some degree, socially influenced. To understand where he was coming from, Vygotsky was working against the prevailing understanding of learning at the time, and one which is surprisingly persistent even today, that the learning mind is basically a copying machine. The idea was that knowledge was somehow something that gets copied or transferred from the mind of a teacher or the content of a book or a movie or, heck, a podcast, into the mind of the student, listener, whomever. The famous Brazilian educator Paulo Freire, whom I am definitely doing a podcast on someday because he's kind of my hero, derisively called this theory of learning the banking model. But right now, I bet there are all sorts of things going on in your environment as you're listening to this podcast. Maybe you're driving your car, dividing your attention between what I'm saying and the road. In which case, please, pay attention to what's out your windshield. I won't be upset. Maybe you're listening on your earbuds while working out in the gym and thinking just now what your process was like in learning how to use exercise machines. Or maybe you're listening as you're taking care of your infant and you're now thinking of connections between how that little person is learning and what you're learning now. Depending on what's going on around you, your understanding of what I'm saying, your construction, Vygotsky would say, of that knowledge, will be different. See, for Vygotsky, learning wasn't about copying. Rather, it was a process of negotiation. He called it a dialectical relationship, which, for someone writing in the late 1920s, early 1930s in Soviet Russia, was probably a pretty familiar and popular word to use. But all a dialectic means is a conversation, an ongoing exchange of influence between one thing and another. In this case, between you and just about everything else and everyone else that's around you as you're learning. That you're always somehow interacting with, being influenced by, and in turn influencing your environment. That environment could be the physical classroom. Doesn't it change the way you learn something, depending on whether the classroom is too hot or too cold, or whether you've got one of those desks with one leg that's just a little too short and it wobbles back and forth? Or, more influentially, the people around you. What you could learn on your own from this podcast, for example, could be shaped, maybe even enhanced, by listening with a friend and chatting it up afterwards, hearing that person's ideas and bouncing them off your own and mine. Vygotsky spent a lot of time writing about the special influence of a teacher as what he called a knowledgeable other, and how that teacher needed to build a bridge of connection between what you already knew and what she wanted you to learn. But for our purposes today, we need to understand that this bridge can be constructed with any other person. It's the whole idea that putting two heads together, or three or four, gives you not only additional perspectives, but actually changes the way that you shape and develop your understanding of a new concept. That's Vygotsky in a nutshell. So you can see how this social constructivist theory of learning would have particular applications to cooperative learning in groups. If you were ever tutored by a friend or an older sibling, if you've ever sat down with your spouse or a significant other to work out an effective budget for your family, if you've ever understood a book better or at least differently after you've talked about it with a book group, then you are experiencing the benefits of group work. As you might imagine, Vygotsky's work wasn't too popular in the United States during the 1950s. It was the Red Scare, and he was a dirty Russian communist, after all. Vygotsky couldn't find much love on either side of the Iron Curtain, as it turned out. His work got him on Stalin's shit list, which may not be surprising, as just about everyone in Russia eventually got on Stalin's shit list, and it resulted in Vygotsky's writings being banned for a while in the Soviet Union. But even today, in our enlightened post-Cold War era, where the theory of social constructivism is taught in pretty much every Western school of education, something in what Vygotsky's saying still rubs some Americans the wrong way. Groups? Dependence on others? What about rugged individualism? Our culturally pervasive American myth of the lone inventor toiling away in isolation? Thomas Edison? Steve Jobs? Well, myths are just that. Myths. And we tend to forget that even these great inventors didn't do it alone. Edison had plenty of assistants, like William Joseph Hammer, for example. Google him. Let alone all the other inventors whose previous work attempting to create incandescent lighting Edison built upon, including Alessandro Volta, Henry Woodward, Matthew Evans, Humphrey Davy, James Bowman Lindsay, Moses G. Farmer, William E. Sawyer, Joseph Swan, Heinrich Goebel, and maybe even some other folks who didn't make the Wikipedia page. That's a pretty big group, even if they all weren't in the same room together working simultaneously. Steve Jobs may have invented the iPhone, but I kind of think there may have been a few hundred other people at Apple, one of the largest corporations in the world, helping him to develop that. Heck, what is a corporation but cooperative work institutionalized for the purpose of generating profitable ideas? Come on, people, even Sherlock Holmes, the most brilliant detective in the fictional universe, teamed up with Dr. Watson all the time to keep himself sharp. So if group work is so awesome, then why do so many of us, remember me included, hate it in school? Well, it took me years to realize it, but the reason I always hated group work was that no one ever taught me how to do it. Working effectively in a group requires as specific a skill set as learning a sport. No coach in her right mind would hand a basketball to a student who had never learned the discrete skills of dribbling, passing, and throwing and tell them, go play basketball, and expect any degree of success. Yet, we're doing something quite analogous every time we just put students in groups and say, go work together, and then we get surprised when it ends up as a train wreck. Teachers and students alike will throw up their arms and say, I hate group work, just as someone might say, I hate basketball, if they're constantly expected to play it without any training. But just as you can break down the skills of playing a sport effectively into distinct tasks, dribbling, passing, and shooting in basketball, you can also isolate and practice the specific skills of effective cooperative work. What are those skills? You probably know them already. My students do. Whether they're teenagers or adults, whenever I first meet them and ask them, they tell me communicating effectively, having clear roles and responsibilities, time management, exchanging leadership, self-assessing, and of course, making sure everyone pulls their own weight, that no one's either freeloading or unfairly taking over the whole show. Of course, I could read 6 books on the art of basketball, and it wouldn't turn me into Michael Jordan. Say what you will about natural talent, even the greats of pro sports don't become all that great until they put in a load of actual practice. So, what does that practice look like in practice in a classroom? Well, there are all kinds of activities that can help students develop those vital skills needed for effective cooperative work. And which ones a teacher employs will vary not only based on the students in the room, but also when during the year these activities occur. Bruce Tuckman and Marianne Jensen's stage theory of group development posits that groups, small or large, go through various stages of evolution: forming, storming, norming, performing, and adjourning. At each stage, the group will have certain distinct needs that must be met in order for the group to function safely and effectively. the teacher can provide activities tailored to the needs of each stage with the goal of helping the group achieve and maintain what writers Sarogi and Baloche call positive interdependence. For any teachers listening, remember, you know your students better than I do. Depending on who they are, you might need to employ more or less scaffolding. You might need to set more or fewer parameters and ground rules for behavior in order to make sure that these activities don't devolve into chaos or are not otherwise abused or distorted. These activities, in increasing order, require students to work cooperatively, to pay close attention to one another and to fine details, to adapt to the actions of others and modify their own actions accordingly, and even to engage in problem solving. These skills will serve students in any number of academic arenas, which can serve as consolation and justification for teachers who might understandably be concerned about spending so much time, especially in the early weeks of school, doing activities that might seem unrelated to the official subject area content they're required to teach. These activities, especially the early ones, are to some extent brain hacks. They don't smell like schoolwork and are therefore more appealing to many students, but they covertly build and strengthen those students' neurology when it comes to cooperative work and higher-order thinking. In short, spending this time is an investment that, hopefully, will yield dividends later on. And some of these activities can be infused as subject area content as well, so you can serve those two aims simultaneously. First, the forming stage. During this first stage, students need to develop a sense of safety and shared identity. And activities that help them do so often resemble popular icebreakers from summer camp or corporate team building, and a quick Google search can reveal dozens of them. The following are just a couple of examples. Toothbrush. Students go around in a circle, sharing the color of their toothbrush and what that says about them. This gives them the opportunity to reveal a personal but low-stakes detail about their lives, the specifics of which they're largely in control of. Mirror. The classic theater exercise where students face each other in pairs, and in silence, one leads with slow, easy-to-follow hand motions that their partner must mirror. The goal for the leader is not to lose their mirror partner through rapid or unpredictable action, but to help that person stay with them, and they later swap roles, so they're eventually challenged to keep on exchanging leadership until it's no longer clear who's leading and who's following, but the two are moving as one. There are any number of active listening activities where a student shares a brief story from their lives on a low-risk, innocuous topic, like perhaps their favorite TV show, while one or more of their groupmates listen, and then need to restate what the speaker just said in their own words, using as much detail as possible. The speaker then decides if the listener is indeed heard and understood them, and the activity repeats until all parties are satisfied. Similarities and differences. Students in a given group must come up with three things you can't tell by looking at them that everyone in the group has in common. And in addition, each student in the group must also provide one such quality which is unique to just that student and shared by none of their groupmates. This activity helps students learn that they might actually have more in common than they suspect and get a peek at some of that iceberg beneath the surface of the water that could revise stereotypes they might have of their peers. At the same time, the unique qualities are a reminder that every single person brings something special to the table that no one else there can provide. As always, you'll want to set parameters around what is and isn't inappropriate to share. The next phase, storming, comes when students attempt group activities with a shared goal and, predictably, conflict occurs. Some students might vie for power or control. Some might become dictators. Some might withhold participation out of either anxiety or laziness. Typically, this is the stage that most group work in middle and high school reaches and never evolves past. The mission of the storming stage is to help groups go through this necessary period of conflict in low-stakes settings, with mandated opportunities to reflect and improve upon the mechanisms by which they work together. Some activities that are ideal for storming include Don't Drop the Ball, a game where students create a collective sentence, each one adding a new word as they go around the circle. The pace should be quick, and each new speaker should add a word that advances the story in a way that makes sense. If the word does not make sense, or if the student takes too long or laughs, the ball gets dropped. The next student in line must immediately take over and restart the sentence. The goal is to keep the sentence going for as long as possible. Active listening and quick adaptation are the skills this activity builds, but also tolerance of and forgiveness of small errors that groupmates or oneself might make. The sentences also tend to get hysterically funny, so even though laughing drops the ball, it also builds cohesion among the group. Joint building activities are also excellent for storming. Tower of Power, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, something where a student group is responsible for building a simple structure, like a tower or a bridge, using certain specific materials. Index cards, popsicle sticks, pipe cleaners, Lego blocks. You impose certain constraints, like the structure has to be freestanding or has to support the weight of an eraser, and a tight time limit, usually 5 minutes or less. The activity is often high energy, and some groups will be more successful than others. But the real goal here is to have a post-game analysis. In it, students in each group need to discuss and determine who showed leadership, how roles were assigned and divided, how the group dealt with new proposed ideas or conflicting desires or moments of frustration and defeat. Then the teacher runs the activity again with the same groups either later that class or the next day, and the groups attempt to change what didn't work for them the last time while repeating strategies that were successful. After all, nothing's really on the line here for them except pride. By the time students are ready for high-stakes cooperative assignments that you're grading, they'll have learned a series of strategies that they know work well for their particular group. Practicing conflict role plays. Conflict at heart is simply a disagreement, a clash of perspectives. Carol Miller-Lieber calls it a natural and essential part of living, and yet in the classroom we usually perceive conflict as a negative phenomenon instead of an opportunity for change and growth. Since most adolescents, and to be fair, most adults, lack tools to successfully and non-violently navigate conflicts, it's usual practice in a classroom for teachers to attempt to suppress conflict as much as possible through both prevention and intervention. But if we want students to engage in collaborative practices, we can't protect them from conflict. Nor should we want to. If there's no conflict, no clash of ideas, then why have the students sharing those ideas at all? Echo chambers do not produce quality learning. Editors argue in a newsroom. Generals disagree about battle plans. Doctors clash over diagnoses and treatment regimens. Ultimately, from this struggle may emerge a solution that no single person could have found on their own, a eureka moment sparked by something someone else said. Yet, as Lieber also writes, young people rarely have an opportunity to learn a systematic way of thinking about conflict or practical processes for handling it. So chances are that when they arrive in your classroom, you'll need to teach them these skills. There are many resources for doing so, and the procedures may already be familiar to you. Communicating using I statements, practicing taking multiple points of view in a conflict situation, and asserting the difference between interests, actual needs and desires, and positions, someone's stated wants, recognizing anger triggers, and practicing anger-diffusing strategies. These skills are often best developed through role-playing exercises, where students can have some fun pretending to be characters in fictional conflict scenarios. Role plays provide low stakes, safe places to practice conflict resolution skills and can serve as valuable anchors to refer back to when real conflicts arise. Remember that scenario when Brenda was convinced Sasha had stolen her phone? Given how our elected officials, media stars, and other public figures model nothing but disdain for those who have different views, the classroom may be the one place where students can learn more constructive approaches to conflict. Despite the name of the stage, not all storming activities are about conflict in abrasive situations. Storm damage prevention and recovery, i.e. building resilience, also needs to be a part of this process. Setting up a regular practice of check-ins, students' chances to let you and their peers know how they're doing that day, and compliments and gratitudes, institutionalized opportunities for students to recognize positive things about their classmates and the actions they've taken, are what these activities are about. Specificity is key. Although there is something to be said for the power of a simple expression like, "Thanks for being my friend," or "You've been very nice to me," the more specific you can get, the more well-received the compliment, gratitude, or other form of feedback will be. These sorts of activities, positive reinforcement, when made routine parts of the classroom, can serve as a kind of inoculation against deliberate antagonism when the time comes for difficult, emotional classroom conversations, and a means of reassurance and reintegration after those difficult conversations might shake things up. The norming stage comes when students settle into routines and patterns that guide their interactions. Now that they know and to some extent trust one another, they are more likely to uphold these norms on the grounds that doing so maintains the positive functioning of the group. The norms can be set up by the teacher, but are often more effective when co-developed with student input. Developing norms around everything from how do we show listening, how do we take turns in speaking, and how and when do we get up from our desks to get materials are all necessary mechanisms that students will have to work out. And at this point, they have enough of a sense of each other from the previous weeks of activities that they can do it in a way that will work effectively for them. And if it doesn't, they can always self-evaluate, go back and, to the extent that the teacher permits, renegotiate those norms. The norming stage can also be a great time to establish the specific group roles that students will take on within the context of their cooperative groups. These roles can include recorder, someone who takes notes, reader, who reads the material aloud, summarizer, who recaps what's been decided or covered in the group, reporter, who reports out an answer or summary to the class or the teacher, timekeeper, to keep the group on schedule, getter, to bring materials to the group and return materials when done, encourager, giving positive reinforcement to other group members, voice control technician, helping the group keep the noise level down, manager or monitor to ensure everyone's doing their work and keeping on task, questioner, challenging the group members to explain or defend their answers, definitions, and strategies, ambassador, visiting other groups to get or share information, going up to the teacher to represent the group when asking a question. Whether these roles are fixed for the duration of a unit, or whether they rotate and students all take on each role in turn, is really up to you. Just remember, like any other routine, students need to practice group roles before they'll achieve mastery. Performing. At this stage, students are finally ready to be enacting the kind of cooperative learning activities that you might have envisioned when you were thinking about group work to begin with. All of that practice and prep work will pay off, and even if it doesn't, post-game analysis with the students, either together as a class or through feedback mechanisms that are anonymous, can help you and the groups make adjustments that keep the class in a good performance zone. The teacher, in turn, needs to allow the students plenty of opportunities to make mistakes, learn from them, and make a comeback without penalties to their grade. Adjourning. If students have spent a unit, semester, or year doing the hard work of coming together as a group and cooperatively tackling tasks, then you don't want to just end on the last day with a bye, have a great vacation. Some sort of concluding ritual is required, and one that is more ambitious than just a pizza party, although pizza can certainly be included. Effective adjournment activities give opportunities for both the teacher and students to formally recognize the positive achievements of individuals, groups, and the class as a whole, to recognize difficult events and congratulate the class on having endured and overcome them, to express statements of gratitude, perhaps in a more extended and elaborate fashion than was done earlier, and to reflect on learning, a metacognitive process that represents some of the highest orders of thinking. Finally, adjournment activities can and should provide an opportunity for students to plan next steps, follow-on learning, and self-assessment of strengths and areas to work on in the future. So as you can see, getting students ready for effective cooperative learning, it's not a short or a simple set of processes. But fortunately, not every exercise in group activity necessarily requires the undertaking of all these processes. Sarogi and Baloch refer to what we've just discussed as the activity of a formal group, a group set up for the explicit purpose of pursuing a sustained high-stakes project together. These are the groups that really have to undergo those many stages of training and development before they're ready to do what the teacher asks of them. Think of it as building a team for a winning season. It doesn't happen overnight. But there are other applications of group work as well. Think of them more as scrimmages, practice matches, short activities for a purpose. Sarogi and Baloch refer also to informal groups, ad hoc, created as needed for a low-stakes task, good for activities like brainstorming, jigsaws, think pair shares, etc. These groups usually last for just one class period or even less. They also talk about base groups for long-term social and identity support. These are groups that can last all year and aren't necessarily engineered for any particular academic purpose. Rather, they exist for long-term social and identity support. The model of student advisories, popular in many high schools these days, reflects the idea of a base group. Now, base groups can be formal groups. In fact, in my classroom, that's exactly how we do it. That way, you can leverage the identity safety and strong bonds the students have created and put those to work when it comes to pursuing a high-stakes task together. Should students remain in the same groups all year long? Well, that's really up to you, the nature of your class, and what goals and activities you have planned. In my own practice, I keep formal groups together at least for the duration of 2 unit projects. That way, the students have the opportunity to look back, reflect, and take lessons from how they put together their first project, and then act upon those lessons to work even more effectively on their second. Should students choose their own groupmates? Again, that depends upon who your students are and what your purposes are for the goals and activities you're laying out. It might be good to let students pick their own friends as groupmates in a base group for identity support, useful for, say, processing a disturbing event that happened in the news. On the other hand, in a formal or informal group that has a specific learning and performance goal, you may wish to select who's in what group to make sure those group members are well-suited to one another, based on how you know they relate to each other, or on their interests, or even on their skill level at the present time. Differentiated groups of students, all at the same readiness level, can help you assign and engage every learner in tasks and activities well-suited to their specific personal needs. Conversely, a mixed readiness level group gives students with stronger skills the opportunity to deepen those skills through the teaching of their peers, and those peers in turn may respond to help better when it comes from a classmate than from their teacher. The point is, setting up your groups should be a conscious, deliberate, well-thought-out process, guided by your learning goals and the knowledge of your students. Grading in cooperative groups is a bugbear, and something I'll return to in more detail in a future episode devoted to assessment. But in brief, your job as a teacher is to ensure that every individual student meets his, her, or their learning goals. So cooperative work can be a scaffold or aid for learning material. At some point, though, you'll need some means of assessing every individual student's mastery of that material. That said, group projects can earn group grades, but there should be identifiable components of those projects tagged to individual students' efforts. That way, you avoid those issues of justice that arise from students who made uneven contributions, but who all share the same grade. Finally, understand that group work is messy. Cooperative learning, by design, produces conflict. Your goal as a teacher is to help students learn how to manage those conflicts in a productive and generative way. It won't always work, just as no technique in teaching always works. But when it does work, the results can be incredible. So there, in about 30 minutes is a primer on how to engage students in group work that not only doesn't stink, but actually enhances their learning and makes possible ambitious projects that are often beyond the reach of singular, individual students. If you want a deeper dive, there's a book I can't recommend enough, The Cooperative Classroom by Linda Baloche. Robin Giles, Elizabeth Cohen, George Jacobs, and Wendy Joliffe also have some good materials here, as do, if you can still find it, David and Roger Johnson in their book, Teaching Students to Be Peacemakers, which is still the best text I've found on helping student groups develop effective conflict resolution skills. Finally, especially given how I've used athletic metaphors throughout this episode, you might want to speak to some coaches. They're really the experts on getting a disparate group of individuals to function as a team, to leverage strengths and improve on weaknesses and come back from defeats even stronger. What happens on the field and on the court every day can also happen in the classroom. One last thing. Remember that students' learning skills and positive interdependence has ramifications far beyond their classroom learning and achievement. No one is born knowing how to work effectively with others on a common goal, and far too many of us reach adulthood without ever having learned these skills. If you want to see the cost of that, just look at Congress. Differences in opinion, belief, and skill set don't have to divide us. Properly leveraged, those differences can make for productive conflict, from which emerges something better and more comprehensive than could have been accomplished in an echo chamber. That's how, you know, democracy is supposed to work. That's all the time we have for now. Class dismissed, and we'll see you next time. I hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you liked this episode, please write us a review on iTunes and like us on our Facebook page. If you really liked this podcast, please consider visiting our website, www.ed-infinitum.com, and making a donation to keep it running. Otherwise, in the grand tradition of underfunded public schools, we'll be reliant on only what we can make from bake sales. The website is the place to go if you want to suggest a topic or send me an email for any other reason. Our theme music is Happy Schoolmaster by Mind Music ID. Thanks again for listening, and remember, every day brings us opportunities to learn something new. Still with us? Awesome! You get a treat! This week's intriguing education fact. Did you know that in the Philippines, there's a school made up entirely of recycled plastic bottles filled with adobe? People in San Pablo collected about 9,000 1.5 and 2-liter bottles and communally built the school to reduce plastic waste around the town. According to Ilac Diaz, the architect, these building materials are 3 times stronger than concrete and much cheaper. It's called the Bottle School, and I imagine that, among other things, it's a great place to learn about environmental sustainability. Bye now.